I will now call the fourth and final case set for oral argument today. That is case number A24-544, State of Minnesota versus Jesse Travis White. I believe counsel are familiar with our procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin. Please identify yourself and your client at the beginning of your argument. For the benefit of both attorneys, I'll mention that the lectern is adjustable. There's a up and down. There's a button on the front edge of the surface that will allow you to do that if you wish.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Casey Wolthy. I'm with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I represent the appellant, State of Minnesota. We're asking today that this court reverse the district court's order suppressing evidence found as the result of a vehicle search conducted without a warrant pursuant to the automobile exception, because the district court in this matter ignored its own credibility determinations and finding of facts, inappropriately distinguished controlling case law without considering those findings of facts, and never conducted a complete totality of the circumstances analysis which is required by the law. Now, I'm largely going to be relying on my brief and my reply brief, but there are two primary areas I want to touch on today. First is how the district court ignored its own findings of fact and credibility determinations and inappropriately distinguished State v. Hawkins. Now, it's very important here that in this case, the district court found that Officer Spies, an officer with 20 years of law enforcement experience who had witnessed thousands of hand-to-hand drug transactions, the district court found his testimony specifically on the point that the hand-to-hand in this case was credible. However, in its analysis, the district court then went on to consider or reason that the hand-to-hand, which occurred out of appellant or the respondent's vehicle, could have been an innocent transaction. This is the exact error that the Hawkins court made. Now, the district court in Hawkins said, well, the conduct could have been perfectly benign. However, it was this court that said the district court wrongly or applied the wrong standard by requiring a greater showing than needed to establish probable cause. And the language used by this court in Hawkins is very important here. They said that the fact that there may have been an innocent explanation for Hawkins' conduct does not mean, and here's the important part, that the officers could not reasonably believe that Hawkins committed a crime. So that's the question here. Was it reasonable for Officer Spies and Detective Wong to consider that respondent committed the crime of felony drug sales? And absolutely it was when you consider all of the evidence. Now here, it's really important that this is where I think the district court committed a critical error. The district court analyzed the evidence in silos, the hand-to-hand, the informant information. The totality analysis, if you could even call that, is four sentences at the end of the order, one of which is really not even a substantive sentence. And the district court never considered how the hand-to-hand could possibly corroborate the informant. However, the district court failed to consider how the informant information, the site of the digital scale, the high crime parking area, the suspicious manner of parking, should all inform how we analyze the hand-to-hand. That analysis never occurred. And when you do that analysis, that disproves any possibility of it not being a reasonable belief that the respondent was selling drugs out of his car.
Could I just ask you one clarification with respect to the scale? It's my understanding that was not ultimately, it didn't seem like Officer Spies really pursued that he wasn't as definite with respect to whether or not it was scale. Clearly something was being done, but there was no scale put into evidence, is my understanding.
There was no evidence that a digital scale was found in the car. But I think on page 19 of the transcript, Officer Spies was definite that it appeared to be a digital scale, which he testified is commonly used to weigh narcotics. And then also at approximately 9:29 p.m. on Exhibit 1, I mean, that's a benefit we have in this case that also distinguishes us from Hawkins, is there's video of the drug sale. And the court can see the respondent digging around in the center console area. And first, you can see what appears to be some sort of probably iPhone, because you can see kind of where the picture lens is on the back. And then the next item he pulls up, that's what Officer Spies testified based on his training and experience, appeared to be a digital scale. The court made a finding of fact consistent with that testimony, and then never brought it up ever again. And certainly the observation of a digital scale in the center console, which is the exact area where respondent was reaching while the unknown the purchaser was standing outside, that informs that this was an illegal drug transaction. Another really critical distinction that the district court really didn't consider when comparing Hawkins was the officer in that case, Officer Willis, had testified he had seen 30 to 35 drug transactions in his career. Officer Spies has seen approximately 1,000. And Officer Wong testified he reviewed the video, and that was consistent with what Officer Spies told him about it being a drug transaction. So between the two of them, 32 years of experience, saying that this was an illegal drug transaction. So the scale, the high crime area, the suspicious manner of parking, the firsthand knowledge from an informant who's been reliable three times in the past, the district court never considered all of those factors in determining if this was an illegal drug transaction.
Could you address the argument that the confidential informant's information was stale?
Yes. So I addressed that in my reply brief, and I think one of the critical, well, first, I dispute that it's stale because it was ongoing for a period of 6 months. And I know the district court took significant issue with the tip in Mosley was contemporaneous. Frankly, I think this court should afford more weight to the informant information in this case, because of the case law that I've provided that says when conduct is ongoing for an ongoing period of time, staleness it's less significant. Also, most of the staleness case laws in the context of a residence, apartment, hotel search warrant case, because when an officer is applying to a judge, they need to show that there's reason to believe that evidence of that crime will still be there. That's why staleness is so important. But this is the automobile exception, a vehicle that could have taken off at any second, or contraband could have been chucked out the window or swallowed, as we so very commonly see. The automobile exception, by its nature, acknowledges that officers sometimes need to move quickly. Beyond all that, though, the information wasn't stale because it was corroborated by the observation of the hand-to-hand, the digital scale, that night. So Officer Spies' observations cured any alleged staleness. So there isn't staleness in this case. The other issue I want to address is how the district court did treat the informant information. Now again, here's a situation where the district court ignored its own findings of fact and credibility determinations. The district court specifically credited Detective Wong's testimony that this was he believed his informant to be reliable. But then in its analysis, the district court said, well, I want more detail. And this is something I didn't address in my brief, was that the district court cited to the Siegfried case, which I believe is from 1978, when it said that more detail is needed. However, there's been a mountain of case law that has come out since Siegfried, and specifically the cases cited to in my brief, Wiley, Munson, and Mosley, which have really reformed or refined Siegfried to say more detail isn't necessary. A simple statement of past veracity is all that is required. In Munson, for example, all they said was they've been reliable in the past. The specific wording in that case was that the informant's information led to an arrest, singular. Here, the informant, we heard from Detective Wong, had led to the recovery of three arrests, or the recovery of evidence on at least three occasions. I think, frankly, this is a situation where Detective Wong probably could have called this informant a CRI, what was, you know, right on the cusp of, is it enough, isn't it? But the important part is there is objective facts in the record to establish this informant's past veracity. So the district court's analysis, citing to Siegfried, wanting more information, goes against more recent and controlling case law. Also, in our law, I think, you know, the district court really, it wanted more information both for the informant's past veracity and the details about how they knew, how they had personal knowledge, which that goes against Mosley. We have really two sliding scales in our case law when it comes to informants. Sliding scales and how much weight or reliability we automatically assign to them based on their title, from anonymous tipster to CI to CRI, all the way up to concerned citizen. And then there's a sliding scale about how there's veracity or past reliability and basis of knowledge. And a deficit of one, or a deficit in one, can be made up for with significant information in the other. And that's what our state Supreme Court recently said in Mosley, focusing on how personal knowledge from an informant is truly the gold standard and should be afforded this significant weight. So here the district court criticized the tip that more info was not known about how the informant knew that the respondent was selling drugs and had a gun, but that is the exact same error the district court made in Mosley and that the Court of Appeals made in Mosley that our state Supreme Court just recently reversed, saying nothing more was required. So given that the district court made the exact errors that the district court made in Hawkins and that the district court made in Mosley, I'm asking this court to complete that totality analysis. And as I've cited into my brief, when that analysis is completed, there is a mountain of evidence when you answer the question, is there a reasonable probability, a fair probability, that evidence of a crime is going to be in that vehicle? And the answer is easily yes. Now, unless there are more questions, I would otherwise rely on my briefs and ask that this court reverse the district court.
So it seems that Mosley, it seems like the facts of Mosley are somewhat similar to the facts of this case, not identical for sure, but so it seems that Mosley is generally helpful for your argument, but to what extent are there differences between Mosley and your case, and then how do we reason through those differences?
I think there's two differences. One, in Mosley, the informant was labeled a CRI by the officer as opposed to just a CI, and our case law establishes that CRIs are automatically presumed more reliability. And that informant had worked with police longer than the informant in this case. The other difference was that the contemporaneous nature of the informant's tip. In Mosley, it was, I'm seeing this person with a gun right now. Whereas in this case, the informant tip was for, you know, a period of 6 months up to 1 month before the vehicle stop. I both have firsthand and hearsay information that respondent is dealing methamphetamine, uses methamphetamine, having the gun. So those are the two differences, but how this court should, I guess, resolve them is completing the totality analysis that the district court didn't. Because in Mosley, all police corroborated was the description of the vehicle, the location, and a very vague description of the suspect. But here, the day of, there was so much more corroboration because police saw that drug transaction happen out of the vehicle. And another important critical point about that drug transaction was that you can see the buyer has his cell phone in his left hand, and it's his body is leaning into the vehicle, and then as he comes out, he immediately pockets his right hand while his cell phone remains in his left hand. But his Ford F-150 is still running, so he's not reaching for his keys. And that's what Officer Spees testified was so critical to him, was not only were they both leaning in so it didn't appear to be an innocent transaction, but was the immediate pocketing of the suspected contraband, which weighed in his experience. And none of those observations were made in Mosley. It was just a guy in a car by a gas station. So given that the police corroborated contemporaneous incriminating details in this case, that's why Mosley weighs in the state's favor of reversing the district court.
Am I correct in surmising that this is not legally relevant, I don't think, but this parking lot is right next door to the Fine Line and then across 4th Street from Pizza Luce?
Correct, in a downtown business district.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, I'm sorry for delaying. Counsel for respondent, you may begin. Please introduce yourself and your clients, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Robert Pauly. I am the attorney for the respondent, Jesse Travis Wright. Good morning, everyone. I, like Ms. Wolthe, too, will rely in large part on my brief, but I would like to respond to a couple things that I think were brought up and weren't accurately characterized. First of all, the Mosley case involved the police receiving a contemporaneous tip that the informant in that case had personally observed ongoing criminal behavior, and the police responded within 30 minutes. And what the tipster said in Mosley was that there was a male, and gave a description of the male, sitting in Winner's gas station in a particular colored SUV and actually gave a license plate. And the testimony at that hearing was that the detective in that case had worked with this informant previously, and that was a CRI versus, in this case, a CI. And within 30 minutes of receiving that tip, a police officer went to the Winner's gas station, observed a car that had the same matching make and model, but also the license plate. That was the corroboration in Mosley. At that point, that car began to leave the Winner's gas station, and it was subsequently detained and a firearm was recovered. That case involved an informant that had personally observed something and was contemporaneously relaying that information to law enforcement, which is an important distinction in this case. In this case, according to Detective Wong, he'd received information from a CI for a period of 6 months. The last information he received regarding my client was approximately 1 month prior. And it's important to note that all the information provided by the CI was that my client was allegedly selling and possessing large amounts of methamphetamine and occasionally possessing a firearm in context with it. There was no information as to where this was occurring, whether it was occurring as a residence or at a car. There's no information of how it was occurring. Was this occurring in hand-to-hand or other sorts of sales? It's very vague information, and according to Detective Wong, only part of that was firsthand observations. Part of it was statements that they had learned from other people. And then you've got Hawkins. Hawkins involved a case where a police officer was on patrol, observed Mr. Hawkins at 1:40 in the morning, riding around a bicycle near the intersection of 27th and Bloomington in South Minneapolis. He saw Mr. Hawkins waving and whistling and trying to attract the attention of passerbyers in car. The police officer observed Mr. Hawkins for, I believe it's a period of 15 minutes, and saw two hand-to-hand transactions. In this case, what we have is we have the informant's tip that predates the date of March 13, 2023, and then we have Detective Wong driving down First Avenue North in Minneapolis, which ironically enough is part of the downtown entertainment district with the restaurants and the clubs that we talk about. But ironically, the Minneapolis First Precinct Station is on the block kitty corner from this. Yet this is still defined as a high crime area. There may well be a lot of criminal activity going on, but there's also a lot of non-criminal activity going on. The characterization of a police officer as something as a high crime area should not define what this court looks into that. And I think that's what the judge was getting at in the district court about the potentially innocuous or innocent behavior. But so as Officer Wong is driving down First Avenue, he notices my client's car backed into a parking lot with its lights on, which in his training and experience, combined with the location that it was in, raised his suspicion. So he noted the license plate, asked his partner to run it, and it came back as relating to my client being registered to him. At that point, it kicked in that, oh, this is the same person that I've been getting this information from my informant about. So he instructed a different officer, Officer Spees, to begin observing this vehicle on the Milestone camera. And for the court's information, the Milestone camera system is set up where Minneapolis police have access to the camera. They can manipulate the cameras. And in this case, they did that. That's what's contained on Exhibit 1. And Officer Spees, when he observed the car, went back and looked at when that car got in there. and noted that the car had been in there about 10 minutes prior to him beginning his observations of it. And he noted that during that 10 minutes, no one came up and approached, nor did my client do anything to try to attract the attention of any passersby.
Can I stop you a minute? So was the driver of the F-150 present at that time in the pickup?
It does not appear so. If the court looks at the video, my client's car is backed in, and I believe it's two or three cars towards the right if you're looking at the front of my client's car. That F-150 was pulled in nose first in a parking lot and did not appear to be occupied. At a particular time on exhibit one, you can see two people. It looks like a father and his adolescent, I believe it's a son, walk towards that F-150. The car is unlocked. The son gets in, the driver gets in, the driver then exits and goes over to my client's car where he leans in the passenger window. And part of what exhibit one I think spoke to was the fact that there were a lot of other people walking by. This isn't simply an area where he's standing there and he's waiting for drug contacts. But he is not doing anything to draw attention to himself or actively engaging in behavior that would be considered like consistent with that of dealing drugs. And so the driver gets out and goes over.
Which way does that cut, I guess? I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that his conduct was consistent with a prearranged buy or sale. I mean, where he had communicated with somebody and this was a meeting point.
Theoretically, it could be, but there's no evidence in the record that shows any of that.
It's just consistent with, I guess.
It's consistent with that along with a lot of other things. But my client has this person leaning in the window, and importantly, you can't see what this person's hands or arms are doing. This has been characterized as a hand-to-hand transaction, but there was no testimony and no evidence, frankly, on the video that there was ever an exchange or that the hands actually met. It was just this driver of the Ford F-150 leaned into the car for a few moments and then took his hands out and put one hand in his pocket. The officers never saw, and nothing is apparent on Exhibit 1, that there was actually anything in that hand.
That does seem to be unusual conduct, however, to lean into a passenger window with your head and your arm. I mean, a person who's got the experience and training, as the officer did here, would naturally think that that was hand-to-hand transaction.
I understand that law enforcement can interpret things in different ways and that they certainly have experience and training that lay people do not. However, that is also consistent with somebody leaning in a car and just discussing something with someone, or perhaps an exchange of money. It could be consistent with any number of things, only one of which might be something illegal.
One thing, you know, and we're, I think, well-versed in the facts, Mr. Pauly, but the credibility determinations that the district court made here do seem to then be ignored in the ultimate conclusions that are reached. How would you respond to that?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that's one of the things I was going to talk about, because the district court made specific findings that both officers were credible when they testified. However, the credibility determination that the court's referring to is that Officer Spies believed he saw a hand-to-hand transaction. The question really is whether that is a reasonable belief. And that's why the district court went through the factual analysis of what was actually able to be observed on that video.
Well, to me, credibility determination is I accept or I believe the testimony of X. It's not X believes what he said to be true.
Well, I don't want to put myself in the shoes of the district court in what her particular analysis was, but I think what I gleaned was that she found both officers credible, but in her analysis, she said Officer Spies believed that he observed a hand-to-hand transaction, but yet her analysis showing what that really showed belied that particular finding. I agree with the court. When a district court makes credibility findings, those are not something the appellate courts are supposed to second guess. But the factual distinctions that the district court made in analyzing that purported hand-to-hand transaction belied that specific credibility finding. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is the idea of the digital scale. And again, I think it goes to the same sort of comments about credibility that you just brought up. In her findings, the district court indicated that she found Officer Spies credible and that he believed that there was a digital scale. Again, there was nothing brought out on the record whether there actually was a digital scale.
Isn't the standard of what evidence there was at the time they conducted the search, not what they found in the search afterwards? Otherwise, it's like, heck, yeah, they found a whole bunch of meth. That's what the confidential informant said. So, and I'm not sure you answered Judge Halbert's question about that. There seems to be missing the totality of the circumstances analysis in the district courts. It's okay, this wasn't good enough, and the CI information, you know, it was at least a month old, and it was not specific, et cetera, and I can agree, actually, with each of those individual steps. And then what I'm questioning, I think, is where the state started their argument is, but if you put it all together, is that enough? And I didn't see that in the district courts. And then even if the district court had addressed it and said, well, I still don't think it's, I mean, what do we do with that? Yeah.
Well, I think obviously the court reviews that particular finding de novo. And so the way I look at it is the court was delineating the two separate sources of information that the state was arguing established probable cause. Mm-hmm. And you've got the information from the CI and the analysis of the reliability of that. And then you've got the conduct that was actually observed by the officers itself. I think you can glean from her opinion, because of the fact she broke it down and then indicated that together they didn't match up to probable cause. The state referred to that as siloing. I think that was a totality of the circumstances analysis without saying that. And I think really what this amounts to, and this was what this really case amounts to, is a combination of both the information provided by the CI and the information observed by the officers in tandem based on experience really amounted to reasonable suspicion. And that's a different standard than probable cause. And perhaps Officer Wong and his compatriots would have been justified in coming in and detaining Mr. White and conducting further investigation to bolster that reasonable suspicion. But I do not believe it amounted to probable cause, and therefore I would ask the court to affirm the decision of the lower court. And unless there are any further questions, I will rely on my brief at this point.
Appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Wothe, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. There's only one area I want to address, and that's the comment about how the district court essentially reasoned there could be innocent or innocuous explanations for the hand-to-hand transaction, that Mr. White could have been patronizing a business, that Mr. White could have been, you know, picking up a friend. But again, here's the benefit we have in this case that wasn't present in Hawkins, is we have the video to show us that Mr. White did neither of those things. All these things the district court speculated about could be happening based on video evidence did not occur in this case. And along those lines, you know, Hawkins, the court...
Can I stop you there? After the hand-to-hand transaction, or the, you know, the interaction with the driver of the pickup, how long did White remain before he started to drive away?
He didn't drive away. Law enforcement stopped him while he was still parked there, and I would say...
Oh, I thought he had just begun to pull away, but no?
I would need to rewatch that portion of the video, but again, the video will speak for itself. It was a very... within a minute, I would say.
Okay, thank you.
And the other thing, you know, in Hawkins, it was really important to the court that he was waving and whistling down suspected buyers. This was a 2001 decision, which means I don't remember the exact date of the conduct, but I think we can reasonably assume 2000, given the timing of our court process. Cell phones weren't in as mass circulation back then as they are now. And to this court's question, wasn't this more consistent with a prearranged drug buy? Absolutely. Because the buyer had his cell phone in hand. And again, the concept that this could have been an innocent conversation, a person doesn't dig around in a center console where a digital scale was during an innocent conversation. The actual facts in the video are not consistent with just discussing. Unless there are additional questions, I would again just rely on my briefs and ask this court to reverse the district court.
I'll just note that on page 7, the district court found that after the F-150 pulled away, the SUV drove forward a few feet as if to leave the lot and then paused. Within 10 seconds, the sheriff squad pulled in front of him. Yeah.
I have no reason to dispute that.
Right,
thank
exactly.
You.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wealthy. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments, both in writing and orally. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by law. That is our final oral argument for the day, so we are now adjourned.